This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be talking with writer Paul Craig Roberts, a Republican who is highly critical of executive overreaching.
Roberts believes we are on the road to tyranny, and possibly we have arrived.
We'll hear several segments from an event held in New York last week on torture.
If you think torture started with Guantanamo, you'd be wrong. This event brought together Black Panthers who were tortured in the 70s in New Orleans and lawyers for Guantanamo detainees, making the link torture as American as apple pie.
We'll also be talking with Matt Callahan about his new book, What's Wrong with Music? All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, ACLU's Arab Muslim South Asian advocate.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
If you really want to know what real Republicans think about what's going on in Washington and what's going on with George Bush and what's happening in this country, our next guest, Paul Craig Roberts, will surprise you with how angry and upset he is with the current administration. Paul Craig Roberts is a Republican. He wrote a recent article called Bush Crosses the Rubicon. If you all remember when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, that was the end of a republic in Rome and the beginning of Imperial Rome. The Rubicon is a river north of Rome. He crossed it with troops. Paul Craig Roberts is a former senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution, not exactly on the left, a former assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, and a prolific, well-known journalist for online newsletters such as Counterpunch. So we're really happy to have with us today Republican Paul Craig Roberts.
Dr. Roberts, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Pleased to be with you.
Your study of democracy and your fear of what's happening in this country are something that I think our listeners understand can't be taken lightly and something they'd like to know more about. You wrote in a recent article, you said, in effect, Bush is asserting the powers that accrued to Hitler in 1933. Can you explain that to us?
Yes. Bush is asserting that he is the law or that he's above the law. He's asserted, for example, which most people should know by now, that he doesn't need to obey the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which definitely applies to him because he's the commander-in-chief and he's protecting us from terrorism during a time of the war on terror. Hitler made a similar claim that following the Reichstag fire, he issued some decree, I forget, something about the protection of the people and state. And so we see here the escape from law of the executive. This is a very serious and dangerous thing. It's in the United States, has a great deal behind it. For example, the Federalist Society, which is a collection of Republican lawyers, and they're united more or less around the goal of increasing the power of the executive. They have written tracts about the imperial judiciary, the imperial Congress, and they think that as an offset to these imperial forces, they have to have an imperial presidency. This is a very serious thing because it is a direct challenge to the constitutional separation of powers.
Can you give me a sense of whether people have gone after you because of this comparison with Hitler and what some people call Fuhrer's Law and whether that's caused you any problems out there?
Oh, I mean, who knows? I mean,
you haven't heard from anybody about it?
Only from hundreds of people who agree and have the same feeling.
That's been my observation, too, particularly since last January 16th on Martin Luther King Day, when Al Gore came out with that really powerful speech indicting the administration the same way you have, of overthrowing democracy, of trouncing the separation of powers and asserting these imperial prerogatives.
I don't know whether democracy is the right word. I think they overthrow democracy when they steal elections. I think that what is being overthrown is the Constitution. And I think it's more important because it is what provides the security of the individual from arbitrary powers of government. If the Constitution comes under assault, as it is, that's a far more serious threat than terrorists or war or any of those things, because without the Constitution, we are not the United States. We've lost the civil liberties, the Bill of Rights, and those are the things that are directly under attack.
Craig, this is Heidi Boghossian. We've read your great article, Bush Crosses the Rubicon. In that article, one of the things you mention is the use, the presidential use of signing statements, which we've discussed on this program, as a means essentially of vitiating the meaning of statutes that Congress passes. A lot of people don't know how many times Bush has actually issued these signing statements. It's many times, and the constitutional challenges that he's raised to the laws passed are numerous. What repercussions do you think these signing statements will have?
Well, it's an assertion that he doesn't have to obey the law, that Congress can pass a statute, but when he makes a signing statement, he's saying, in effect, I don't have to follow it. I don't know how many times I read it's hundreds and hundreds of times he's done this. I think I saw that he has done it more than all combined presidents put together. So whereas in the past you could say it's a point perhaps of legislative and different interpretation of what the statute is supposed to do or something between the administration and the president, with Bush it seems to be a conscious claim, staking out a position that I don't have to pay attention to what statutes Congress pass. I have my own view of what I'm going to do, and that's it. So this is a very blatant claim, essentially, of rule by decree or rule by I am the law. It's what I say, not what Congress says.
Dr. Roberts, step back for a second. Let me ask you, I guess, a sociological question. I remember when Eisenhower left office and he gave that great speech about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, and I suppose now you could add the military-industrial and spying complex. My question to you is, what kind of social forces do you think are behind Bush? It's not just Bush, but what is this power grab and this really trouncing of the separation of powers and what used to be a respected constitutional system? What's behind this?
Yeah, some things come to mind right away. One, it's the Federalist Society, which has been around since about 1982. Its explicit goal is to increase power in the executive. You may remember a book written some years ago called Energy in the Executive. It's actually intellectual, legal, attorneys, law professors, and they're pushing this line. It's one thing. Another thing is there's tremendous frustrations among various elements of the population who believe, for example, that Roe versus Wade was an example of the Supreme Court legislating, creating statutory law where there was no constitutional protection. And so they look for a strong executive to correct the imperial judiciary. You have other elements out there who think that Congress simply is they always frustrating and keeping the president from doing the right thing, and they want to remove that constraint on executive so that he can do the right thing. So those are some of the elements pushing it. A third, I think, is sort of a Jacobin spirit. The Jacobin spirit is that America has some unique virtue, and it has the duty and the right to correct and straighten out the rest of the world, and this requires executive power and decisive action and not constant bickering by Congress or everything delayed by long, drawn-out court decisions. You can say that the neoconservatives and the Federalist Society and many of the frustrations among various single issue groups support this sort of move.
I was just going to add that the Federalist Society is so highly organized with chapters in every law school in this country and sort of an informal mentoring program to bring them into high levels of government with a lot of funding from conservative foundations and individuals. When you worked in the government, I know one of the things people say about the Federalist Society is they don't always claim credit for what they do because a lot of their efforts would be prohibited under their 501c3 IRS determination. When you were in the government, is it commonly known that the Federalist Society have this well-orchestrated plan to sort of change the political climate and the legal climate of this country?
I think the Federalist Society's claim is that it stands for original intent. And I think then there was support among conservatives to have the Constitution interpreted as original intent and not a great open-ended document that could support anything anybody wanted, no matter how left-wing or whatever. And so there was support for the notion that the Constitution meant something and that there had been judicial decisions that went way beyond anything that could be called a constitutional protection. So there was support for that. Now, in practice, I don't know exactly why original intent gets hooked up with more power in the executive, because that's obviously not the original intent of the Constitution to have an imperial executive or an imperial presidency. So how that transition came about, I don't know. I can't fathom how you get from original intent to busting up the separation of powers.
Dr. Roberts, let me ask you something of a more personal nature. How did you evolve from a figure in the Reagan administration, a person that worked on the National Review and the Wall Street Journal, to somebody who's really quite, in my point of view, eloquent and really effective critic of the leader of the Republican Party? What was your Rubicon?
Well, you know, conservatives have always been critical of the Republican Party. National Review used to be a conservative publication before Bill Buckley turned it over to the neoconservatives. It's a neoconservative publication. Neoconservatives are not conservatives. They are Jacobins. You know what a Jacobin is. That's the French Revolution type, the type that we're going to remake the world in our image by force and blood. That's the Jacobin. That is not conservative. So the neoconservatives came out of the left. They got into the conservative movement because they were seen as stalwarts against the Soviet Union. But they're not conservatives. And I don't think at the time conservatives realized what their agenda was or that they had a Jacobin frame of mind. I don't think that showed enough for people to notice. And conservatives have always opposed big government, unfettered powers. They've always clung to Jefferson, to accountability, to the separation of powers. They've clung to what Blackstone called the rights of Englishmen, which are essentially the constitutional amendments, the Bill of Rights. And they've always defended those things, and they've always warned about danger of large government because of its powers. And then if those powers become unfettered, even more so. So when I was a young man, we spent most of our time fighting the liberal left, who trusted government, wanted to have more power so that it could do more good. And that used to be the argument. You don't see that anymore. I think perhaps maybe the liberal left has learned that giving the government more power doesn't always achieve more good. I think what happened is every group, with the exception perhaps of some of the libertarians and the old true conservatives, every group at one point or the other aligned its agenda with big government. They wanted to use the government to advance their agenda. And I think now people just think and act that way. I don't, you know, the Republicans probably think they're just being normal when they use the powers of government or try to expand them in order to push their agenda.
We're speaking with Paul Craig Roberts on Law and Disorder. Dr. Roberts, you've recently written that we're really on the verge of having a dead democracy in the United States. If dead democracy means midnight, what time do you think it is, and what can we do about it?
Well, it's like one reader wrote to me recently and said, if the President of the United States can proudly declare himself to be a felon and it has no consequences, then the game is up. And this is what he's doing with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. He's simply saying, I don't have to obey the law. If he gets away with that, I would say the reader's right. The game's up. If they can hide behind the war on terror and the fear and hysteria and the disinformation they generate, and again come out of the 2006 election with both houses of Congress, then we know that the American people aren't clued in and have probably lost the opportunity to stop the momentum toward rule by decree from the executive branch. I think these are the two biggest tests. And the third, of course, is if he gets away with going to war based on lies and deception. They may expand that. You see, they're now working on Iran with the same line. There are three tests. If they get away with these three things, then I would say that government has undergone a fundamental change, and it will be hard to restore accountability.
Given the gravity of the situation, what's your position with respect to impeachment?
Oh, I think he should be impeached. I think it's urgent. It should have already happened.
Are you getting much support from people that you associate with in terms of that position?
They say, well, how can it happen? The Republicans control both houses, and all the people think that we're going to be blown up in our beds. So, who are the people I associate with? I mean, look, Reagan is not George Bush. Reagan, there were neoconservatives in the Reagan administration. He went along with some of their schemes. But when they went too far, he fired them. George Bush promotes them. All Republicans are not the same. You see, Reagan was viewed as an outsider by the Republican establishment. They weren't all that pleased with him. They didn't want him to have enough success that the succession could go to another outsider because it was a threat to the establishment's hegemony over the party. There's a lot of conflict among Republicans. I published a book in 2000 called The Tyranny of Good Intentions, which is, of course, a publisher's title. What the book is about is the erosion of the fundamental legal principles that make law a shield of the people instead of a weapon in the hands of the government. And I run through these things, such as the attorney-client privilege, mens rea, you know, no crime without intent, no ex post facto laws, no self-incrimination. And I show that all of these things are already so badly eroded, and prosecutorial abuses are already so extreme, just in the ordinary criminal courts, that there's very little protection there. A president or a powerful executive doesn't have to push very hard because so much has been eroded. And I have been writing on these themes probably for 15 years. I gave a lecture at a university which started it all off, I think, around 1990, noted that we would all severely miss Justice Brennan. And I think that we do miss him, and we're going to miss him worse with an Alito Roberts court.
Yeah, that's for sure. What did you think of the Lynn Stewart conviction?
I thought it was outrageous.
And why?
Well, I wrote about it at the time.
Yeah. Well, I remember when you wrote about it because it was so eloquent when you were talking about how she was convicted on the strength of a prosecutor's letter. A special administrative measure. They told her you're not supposed to tell the world what your client says, and Lynn Stewart went out and ignored it and issued a press release, and it was on the basis of that press release that they convicted her of conspiracy and want to send her to prison for 26 years.
When did a prosecutor's letter become a statute?
Yeah, exactly.
See, that it's already eroded. The prosecutor's letter, the prosecutor is saying, I am the law. My letter is the law. That's just like Bush saying, my word is the law. You see what I'm saying? It's identical.
Yeah.
What Bush is doing, he's just really picking up on what prosecutors have been doing for years. They take some minor infraction and they criminalize it in some way. It's not on the statute book.
Yeah.
This is very, very serious. It's been going on a long time. The law schools just turn a blind eye. The bar associations turn a blind eye. We're set up for tyranny.
Dr. Roberts, one last thing. Do you have a website so we can make a link with our website and get our listeners in touch with you and so they can read your articles?
They can read most of my things on Counterpunch.
Terrific. Terrific.
They are also, the non-economic ones are on libertarian sites like antiwar.com or lewrockwell.com.
We've been talking with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. It's good having you in our corner, Dr. Roberts. Thank you very much for being a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed being with you.
Okay. Thanks again. So long.
next segment is part of the program that took place at Riverside Church, where members of the Black Panther Party, tortured in the 70s, came together with lawyers and others from Guantanamo to talk about torture in America and torture abroad. It was a wonderful program, and when you hear some of this testimony of the Panthers in the 70s, you realize that what this country now does abroad, it certainly has done at home.
First, with a discussion of what happened not only yesteryear or what happened in the past, but what is continuing to happen with our dear brothers and sisters in the Black Panther Party, who find themselves once again at the brunt of the heel of the intelligence community in this country. We have to share with you their experience, not only of what happened, but what is happening. Harold Taylor, who was born and raised in South Central Los Angeles and joined the Black Panther Party for self-defense. In 1973, he was arrested in New Orleans with a number of other members of the party and subjected to abuse and by law enforcement authorities, which he will share with you. He'll soon be joined also by John Bowman, who was born in San Francisco, as one of the Black Panther Party members who was arrested and also subjected to abuse in New Orleans. And finally, Hank Jones, born in New Albany, Mississippi. He's a retired journeyman machinist, a lifetime activist who recently was held in contempt for refusing to testify before the grand jury in San Francisco.
I was at City College doing a radio program called Harlem 411, and I was being interviewed by a couple of people who wanted to talk about what happened in San Francisco, California, at the federal grand jury, and what happened to me in New Orleans. And so I guess I can just continue this radio interview and this process. I've been in New York since 2 o'clock yesterday, and I've been on two different radio programs, and it's been quite helpful to me to discuss the process that took place in New Orleans and to discuss the process that I'm limited to about the federal grand jury and the process of being subpoenaed and being bought airplane tickets by the Federal Task Force for Anti-Terrorism. You know, they bought me airplane tickets so I could fly to San Francisco and to be put in front of a federal grand jury. But prior to 2003, I had not discussed or engaged in any dialogue or tried to share with people the process that happened in New Orleans, except with my family and my closest friends and a doctor who had to operate on my shoulders because of the corporal punishment. I've had two operations on both of my shoulder blades because that's where a lot of the corporal punishment was paid attention to by the New Orleans police. So I hadn't really discussed it in a public way, in a way that probably I needed to do. And the reason why I didn't do that was because two reasons. One, I didn't think that people would really be sensitive to the information that I would share with people, because it's quite humiliating and it's quite painful to talk about somebody doing corporal punishment on your body when you're butt naked and handcuffed to a chair with your arms behind you and behind your feet shackled to a chair. It's quite painful to do that and it's humiliating. So that's one of the reasons that I decided that I didn't really want to talk about it. But after being forced to appear in front of a federal grand jury in a room in San Francisco in the federal building with 25 strangers, and none of these people that I know, and I was isolated in a room, and there's a court reporter, and there's a table like this here, and there's the federal prosecutor, there's a state prosecutor, and then over to my left, there's 25 people all staring at me, just looking at me. And then there was a a laptop sitting on the table with slides that they were shown about the Black Panther Party and about people in the Black Panther Party and about people who were in the Weather Underground and about people who were associates of the Weather Underground, the Peace and Freedom Party, and all these people were staring at me. I'm sitting in a chair, not handcuffed this time and not naked, but I'm still feeling as if I'm getting ready to be tortured, you know? And I'm looking at these people, and they're looking at me, and I'm taking the Fifth Amendment, I'm taking the 14th Amendment, I'm taking my constitutional rights not to testify or not to answer 35 questions that related to people that I knew in California, people that I knew across the country. And these questions are coming, and I'm taking the Fifth Amendment and other amendments, and I'm feeling like I'm back in New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm feeling like I'm being tortured again. Because the same people who are asking me the questions and the same ones are preparing the questions for the federal prosecutor are the same people who was in New Orleans, Louisiana, the San Francisco police. These police officers, Officer Frank McCoy and Officer Edward Erdelax, they prepared the script to ask the questions. They prepared the whole process. And these are the ones who, I'm sure Mr. Taylor told you, when the questioning was being facilitated and the questions weren't answered, they would usher us back into the room where we were stripped naked and again tortured and asked questions. No questions, I'm sorry, just corporal punishment. So I felt compelled after getting out of jail in October 31st of 2005 for refusing to testify in front of the grand jury. I felt compelled that I could no longer just let this thing be a secret. This instrument here is a 21st century cattle prod. When I say 21st century, because back in 1973, it was just a one piece. This piece here, where the batteries are, and this piece on the end right here is where you get the electric shock. Okay? But in the 20th century, in 1973, this was just a one piece. And on the end here was a button that they would push. And upon your body, this would be touching your body, and it would send electrical shock. This little box here holds eight batteries, eight double D batteries. The other one in the 20th century, it holds a dozen batteries, and it was about this long. So imagine, if you could, it being placed in your anus, being placed under your arms, being placed on your back, any place where there is moisture, which would accelerate the shock. This is a blanket, just an ordinary blanket. But this blanket in 1973 was used to, it was put over my head. They would take it out of a wool blanket, and I would be sitting in a chair similar to this. I can still talk. And I'm handcuffed. The blanket is wet, coming out of a bucket of hot water. I'm handcuffed. I don't have on any clothes. My feet are shackled to the chair. And the cattle prod is being used. And they're beating me across my shoulders, beating me on my knees, and beating me under the bottom of my feet for the purpose of not getting information, but just to terrorize me. Okay? Since 1973 until 2005. No, in fact, it was in December 2005 when we did a presentation in Washington, D.C. at the TransAfrica Board. That was the first time that I decided to do it publicly, because I just thought it was no longer a personal matter anymore. If the Patriot Act and the COINTEL Program Act could be the same, to me, it was all the same. So that's why I decided to become part of the Committee to Defend Human Rights, which we decided to do this in October 31st when we were released from the San Francisco County Jail for refusing to participate in the grand jury process. You know? And that's all I have to share.
Have something a little bit unusual today on Law and Disorder. The usual for us, you know, are all the atrocities that the Bush administration is committing, from Guantanamo to torture to warrantless spying. But our program is a law program. And in American culture, ultimately, culture is run by law, and in this instance, copyright law. We have as our guests a working musician here in New York, Eli Smith, and Matt Callahan, a working musician on the San Francisco scene, who's just written the wonderful book, The Trouble with Music. His position is there's got to be a different way. Music is terrible, I think, as everybody will agree. The good music that's out there, it's hard to find. And ultimately, copyright law, which Matt tells us in his book, comes down to protecting the interests of a very few, very rich handful of music corporations. Copyright law has to be done away with, and an alternative system has to be created if we're going to allow people out there to really appreciate good music. Nice to have you here, Matt.
Nice to be here.
I want to tell the listeners, Matt Callahan has just written his third book, The Trouble with Music, and we're going to be talking about just what the trouble with music is. And I'd also like to welcome New York City musician Eli Smith. Eli, nice to see you here.
Hey, Dad. Good to be here.
Yeah, I should have said that. full disclosure, I have to tell our listening audience that Eli Smith's my son. Matt, you were on the music scene in San Francisco in the 80s and the 90s, and you've also written what I think is really a thoughtful, intelligent book on what the trouble is with music. Being on Law and Disorder, you know, we like to get the legal angle, and I'm going to get to that. But first, I wanted to ask you, tell us a little bit about yourself as an artist, and then I wanted to talk to you about the essence of this book.
Well, I've been playing music most of my life, born and raised in San Francisco, and was involved with, as you mentioned, in the 80s, I was involved with a band called The Looters. We were part of a group of people who formed the artist collective Commotion International, which was a art gallery, performance space, recording studio, and sound magazine that ran for 11 years in San Francisco. I've basically been writing and singing songs for 40 years. And, you know, and now I got a job in Switzerland, so that's why I'm coming from there back to here.
Well, you're here promoting The Trouble with Music.
Yeah.
It's a book that's recently been published by AK Press, the anarchist press, put out a lot of interesting titles. In a nutshell, what is the trouble with music? I know that in the book you talk about how the
60s, the radicalization of the 60s scared the pants off the powers that be in this country, and that the music business in the 60s was a lot different than it is now, and that the owners of the music business took considerable steps to change the kind of music that comes out and is available. And in that context, tell us, will you, just what is the trouble with music today?
Well, I chose the title because it opens the door to the, you might say, the conflict or the division between what is trouble and for whom. And so on the one side, as you suggested, I refer to the 60s as not a specifically chronological time between 61 and 69, but an era of world revolution in which actually, not only in the United States, but globally, the role of music was, you know, in the center. It was perceived, certainly by my generation, as the oracle of truth and the voice of social change. And it clearly had this preeminent status, which not only, you know, had a political character in the sense of the lyrics of Bob Dylan songs or Marvin Gaye songs or something like that, but music itself was the expression of youth rebellion in the United States and other parts of the world. And, of course, this trouble with music is the trouble for the people who want to control it and the people who want to control society. And on the other hand, as you said, after the tide and the surge of energy that arose in the 60s receded, obviously one of the forms of social control that was exerted by, particularly during the Reagan-Thatcher years, was directed specifically at restoring order, if you will, to the youth culture. And this coincided with the development of you might say the corporatization of everything, and within the field of music in particular, or entertainment in general, you had the mergers and acquisitions that consolidated all of the indie labels that had thrived during the 60s, making them all parts, even if their names continued to exist in the public mind or in the marketplace. These were consolidated into what were five majors and are now down to four, with Sony merging with BMG. And it'll probably end up being two or three in the next few years. And these are not even record companies anymore. All of these companies are really owned and are part of much larger conglomerates, in the sense that, Philips, which is a manufacturer of a variety of technological gadgets, and Sony are at the tops of corporate structures that have bought up record companies to make the software for their hardware. In other words, they make the CDs, the physical CDs, they make the equipment that plays it, and they wanted the software, meaning the music, to sell their hardware.
Yeah, it's called vertical integration. When Ford put out cars, he made everything from the doorknobs to the windshields. So there's four basic companies that control most of the music worldwide. And legally speaking, how do they keep control over it with copyright laws? And what is your position on copyright laws?
Oh, and if I can interject something here, this is Eli speaking. I also want to ask, why would they want to arrange things this way? What's in it for them? Is music part of a larger issue, such as the ownership of other ideas like pharmaceutical drugs? Are there alternatives to the present copyright regime? Why is music such a strange commodity to try to sell?
Mm-hmm. Matt Callahan, what's your reaction to about six questions we've shot at you?
To begin at the beginning of the sequence of questions, I would say, first of all, when I began the researches for this book, the internet downloading issue of file sharing had only begun. And I had originally not even intended to get into it, because I don't consider it particularly relevant to music, how music makers are affected. On the other hand, by the time the book was completed, the publisher insisted that I write about it because it had become such a huge issue. Anyway, that background is simply to say that I went into it knowing that I would have to study copyright law, not music, because that's where the issues are really sharp. And in this process, I didn't come into it with a hypothesis. I went into it and discovered what was really going on with copyright law and arrived at the conclusion that copyright should be abolished.
And why do you think that?
I think that because for two reasons. First of all, the fundamental justification of copyright is supposedly to give credit and just compensation to the composer or the creative idea.
Yeah, exactly.
And it fails to do that. And in fact, it has gotten to the point where instead of doing that, it's actually doing the opposite. The ostensible purpose was that from the very beginning. In 1710, with the first modern copyright law, the Statute of Queen Anne, it was stated explicitly that the copyright was for this purpose, to protect the author. And in fact, in addition to that, a separate category was created called the public domain, which was, from that point on, has been used in virtually all the treaties right up to the Berne Convention of 1976, where the various countries that are privy to this or have joined in this these treaty agreements agree that this is the purpose, that there is the public domain on the one side, which is what everything falls into if it is no longer held by a copyright holder. And on the other hand, they agree that the copyright guarantees that the holder of the copyright will receive the revenues generated from the sale of the copied goods, whether it's a CD, a player piano roll, a book, whatever.
So who makes the money, and how do the creative artists down on the bottom of the food chain get iced out on this?
Well, what happened originally, when particularly when we're talking about music, music was a relatively small business. That has to be kept in mind, and that actually its main function up until World War II was really it supported other things like film. And it, of course, there were symphonies and there was popular culture, but popular culture wasn't a big moneymaker.
When did music get to be a big moneymaker?
Well, it really began after World War II in the way we're speaking of, where you might say the triumph of popular culture that really took place in the 60s. I mean, finally the bourgeois arts were sort of blasted off center stage and were replaced by the popular arts throughout the world. And with this, record companies developed that took the popular culture, and at that time we're speaking of everybody from Ray Charles to Aretha Franklin to the Beatles to whatever, and saw these enormous sales they were absolutely unprecedented. And along with that, of course, went hi-fis becoming stereos and so on and so forth. There was, again, a technological linkage that was very important and still is. I mean, this is always the way it works. It walks on two legs. With radios used music, which was given away for free, to sell radios. That was the original way music was used to sell radios, the box. And the same thing is being done with Steve Jobs and the iPod. He uses the radio as his model. In other words, the selling of the iPod means we give away the music. I mean, 99 cents is not profitable to Apple. And it's like the iPod is sold by the music that's given away essentially for free. That's the way music has been used. And what it reveals is that music ultimately has no value. It is a valueless object. In fact, it is not an object. It is a disturbance of the air, which provides pleasure, joy, feeling, emotional reward, or whatever. And so we value it in the sense that we value virtues, or that we value an emotional expression that gives moves us. But it doesn't have economic value, which means price. You cannot establish the equivalence between Bach's Art of the Fugue and John Coltrane's The Love Supreme. There is no equivalence between these two things. And in fact, music is like movement. Movement is defined by an object being in one place and not in one place at the same time. And music simply enters the air and goes out of the air. What objectifies it is the piece, whether it's paper, whether it's a vinyl record or something else, that freezes it in time. But music itself only exists in the air.
Right.
Do you understand what I mean? You can't listen to a piece of paper sitting over there. A trained musician can sight read it and hear in their head what the music may sound like, but actually the sound only exists in the air.
Look what they done to my song. Look what they done to my song. Well, it's the only thing that I could do half right, and it's turning out all wrong, Ma. Look what they done to my song. Look what they done to my brain, Ma. Look what they done to my brain. Well, they picked it like a chicken bone, and I think I'm half insane, Ma. Look what they done to my soul. I wish I could find a good book to live in. Wish I could find a good book. Well, if I could find a real good book, I'd never have to come out and look at 'em.
We're speaking with Matt Callahan, who's just written this bombshell of a book called The Trouble with Music. AK Press put it out, the Anarchist Press, The Trouble with Music. And Matt's on a book tour here in the United States, and we've been discussing just what is the trouble with music. Coming back to the intellectual property law question,
right?
You know, do the musicians who create the music get compensated? If you're going to advocate getting rid of copyright laws, what's going to protect these artists? What's going to give them income if they create something and it's immediately stolen by a big corporation?
That's exactly the problem, is that it is immediately stolen by big corporations. That is the problem. Prior to copyright law, and in fact, really prior to recent times, very recent times, most music was either free or was paid for by somebody. In other words, somebody was hired to play at a wedding, or a king hired somebody to play at their court. And it was, there was no question of making money from music. The musician was compensated directly by the patronage system. Whether it was, you know, some poor slob who wanted somebody to play at their bar mitzvah, that was, you know, was actually a wealthy man who wanted to show off his wealth, the musician was simply directly compensated as if for labor or for the exchange of services. They were like a menial servant. For most musicians, I can speak with the authority of experience, that for most musicians, gigging means getting paid and being treated very much like a menial servant. Whether you're doing a corporate gig downtown New York where they're hiring you to be playing background music while they have their buffet and, you know, Chase Manhattan is, you know, supplying ambient culture, okay, that's might be a good paying gig for a really fine musician. But you're going to be treated exactly like a menial servant. And the reason that's so significant is that actually historically that is the way music has always been. It's actually a change. And this is what defenders of copyright are always arguing. Well, but it's good because at least now some songwriters and composers, some, are getting rich, you know, along with the rich patronage system that has just hired them in the past. And it is true that some people have become very wealthy. You might even number that in the tens of thousands worldwide composers have gotten money. But that leaves aside two basic facts. One, that there are millions of musicians who've never been paid and are still alive and working today. This is not just you know, black slaves. It's like there are millions of working musicians who've written compositions that have never gotten a dime for their creative input. And secondly, the system by which copyright holding operates actually militates against society taking a position to justly compensate all creative effort. And this is where you run into the problem where the justification of copyright justifies society not through taxation or some other system of disbursement of funds, taking a public interest in the arts and saying, we will support the arts, and therefore musicians should be compensated on some equivalency. In other words, it won't be necessarily on aesthetic grounds because, as I said before, you can't make an equivalency for that. But you could say for labor input, for the amount of time one spends practicing, or on a commission basis or whatever. There are many, many suggestions that your listeners can go to the internet to look for, because there are a lot of legal scholars who are fighting very hard against the current copyright regime, not only for musicians, but for a lot of reasons, because it is clearly getting in the way of real innovation or real creativity.
I just want to remind our listeners, we're speaking here with two of our guests, Matt Callahan, who's just written the book, The Trouble with Music, and New York City musician Eli Smith. Eli, you had asked a question before that Matt was going to answer about intellectual property, say, as it results to drugs and the pharmaceutical laws.
Music is just a small part of a larger issue, and I know that you've been doing some work on that, and I was wondering if you could speak to that as well.
My focus in the book began with the internet, the file sharing issue. But obviously, once you get into that, you start to realize that there's a much larger issue going on, which is, first of all, enclosure of the commons. And in this case, the commons is the internet. By the same means that were used in the original enclosure of the commons in Europe, where you drive the peasants off the land, you take you make property of this common space, they all go into the factories, to the dark satanic mills. And so on the one side, that's happening again. Music is used as a stalking horse, because, you know, a lot of young people are doing this file sharing, downloading thing, and their heroes are musicians. So we get the musicians on this side saying, hey, I'm being victimized. You know, Metallica came out and attacked Napster in the very beginning, so
right,
it was like
right.
This. And so you create this completely false dichotomy between fans and musicians, and the people that are really behind this and who are really making the money and are worried about what might happen with file sharing are big drug companies and the big telecommunications giants, who are much more concerned about actually the human genome than they are about music. Music itself is a relatively small thing. It's not that big a deal. You're dealing with control of ideas and the transformation of intellectual thoughts, ideas, creativity into private property, which has not yet been completely done. And in fact, it was only in 1976 that the copyright law extended to lifetime plus 50 years. You know, the original copyright law, you might say, was a compromise that, you know, originally Thomas Jefferson and the founding fathers agreed to after much debate at 14 years, which you might say, okay, well, this is sort of a concession, whatever, it's all right. But in 76, things began to change. And this is actually the basis why, when the internet exploded with the concept of the information superhighway, where's the piece d'evidence? It's being spent in Iraq, and we're dealing with a situation in which the greater impoverishment of more and more musicians on the one side, while a few rich rock stars have their millions protected.
These like rock stars or that are used as a mouthpiece for these faceless corporations. To speak out against file sharing and things like that.
Right. Even the rich rock stars have actually become silent of late. It was only at the very beginning. Metallica withdrew their complaint. They backed down, and people like Prince have come forward recently making really, really wonderful and eloquent statements about rotten this whole thing is, and many other musicians are absolutely neutral about it. They won't say because, first of all, the verdict on the whole issue is not clear at all. Harvard did a study 2 years ago that proved – from their data, proved, you could question any proof, but they did a study of the actual correlation between the decline in sales and the amount of file sharing, and they found that there was absolutely no causal relationship between the two. The impact of file sharing could actually have increased sales as much as decreased sales.
Right. I just want to interrupt for a second, remind our listeners here on Law and Disorder, we're talking about the law of intellectual property right with respect to music, the copyright law. We have as our guest Matt Callahan, just wrote the book The Trouble with Music, and our second guest Eli Smith, who's a New York City working musician. Matt, again, to come back to the title of the book, The Trouble with Music. Music today, you mentioned Coltrane before. I heard him play live. I heard the Beatles live. I mean, music was great. And today it seems to be turned into its exact opposite. And you write in the book about how they've made music into a commodity. Mm-hmm. How do you make music into a commodity?
Well, that's what we're talking about now. And I mean, the thing is that, first of all, in order to do it, there are two very important steps that have to be taken. First is that you have to limit access. And musicians, by nature, don't want access limited. The reason you make music is to build a community, to build an audience. And limiting access means concert halls, tickets to get in, copyrights, not allowing people to use it without paying. This is one of the basic steps of it being turned into a commodity.
Matt Callahan has been involved in the music industry for over 30 years. He was the founder of the legendary San Francisco performance space, venue, recording studio, audio magazine, Commotion, and founder, singer, songwriter, guitarist of island recording artists, The Looters, who in 1980 were instrumental in popularizing world music. He has worked as an engineer, manager, and producer. He currently lives in Switzerland, where he works full-time as a producer and continues to perform his own material as a solo artist. And thanks also go out to Eli Smith, who's a working artist here in New York City, old-time music and a music teacher, currently working on the forthcoming old-time music show that'll be on Air America. Our thanks go out to both you, Eli Smith, and you, Matt Callahan. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.